to today's program on the Aquila Report and Weekly Review. It's a podcast that I, Dominic Aquila, and Paul Harrell bring you week to week with the top 10 articles that were on the Aquila Report that the Aquila Report readers looked right at and click and read the most. And that's how we get to our top 10. And so we always invite you to go visit daily the aquilareport.com so that you can click on articles and help produce whatever the next top 10 is for the following week. But it's always a joy to be here to review these articles that the Aquila Report readers have given to us. And these will be on the listed in the newsletter that is sent out on Tuesday. So today is Monday, May 22, 2023. And so tomorrow on the 23rd of May, you will receive the newsletter, all titled and hyperlinked. So you, all you do is click on them and you can see what the top 10 were. So if you're listening to beforehand, it gives you a prelude. If you're listening to this after the you've received your list, hopefully you can interact with us and share what you we say and what you say maybe with other people as well. So anyway, Paul, we're ready to get through the end, almost the end of May already, if you can believe that, for 2023.
Wild.
So ready to have our discussion. What's going on in your world?
Everything's good, you know, in my world. Just ready to go through this top 10 list one more time.
That's right. It's good. And it's a good variety here as well. So it's I think it'll be challenging for us to sort of keep it under control because it's there's so much that we can what we can say. Okay, well, Paul, let's do our normal routine and you read the top 10 to 10 to 6 and then I'll read 5 to 1 and then we'll get started.
All right, number 10, we have Jacob Crouch, Faithful, Fruitful, and Forgotten. Coming at number 9, UMC Bishops Request 2026 General Conference as hundreds more churches disaffiliate. Number 8, Jonathan Van Maren, The Emergence of a New Paganism, an interview with Chantal Delsol. Hope I'm pronouncing that right, or Delsol. Coming in at number 7, we have The Two Kingdoms, Theology and Christians Today, written by William B. Evans. And number 6, Defending the Idol by Dawn and Joy Vainet.
Okay, then number 5 is by Amy Hall, a response to an employer's request for pronouns. And then number 4 is an article, that's what it's loading here, by Carlton Wynn, Machen and the PCA Today. And number 3, schools in the Presbyterian Church in America. This is referring to schools attached to churches. Written by Matthew Lee. Number 2 is the regarding the death of Tim Keller. He's called Home to Glory by Andrew Shaughnessy. And then number 1 is PCA minister, Reverend Harry Reeder, Briarwood Presbyterian Church, killed in a car accident. And so we'll probably do this is take these two together, Paul, since we're dealing with two significant individuals whom the Lord chose to call home last week. Harry Reeder, a longtime pastor for the last 24 years or so of the Briarwood Presbyterian Church in Birmingham, Alabama. And then Tim Keller, who was for many years, probably about 30 some years then, the founder of the Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City, and also instrumental in the planning of many other churches in not only that area, but around the world, starting a ministry called City to City. He also was called home the day after Harry. And so we mention these because both of these men, well-known, well-loved, with distinctive ministries in the Presbyterian Church in America, just one day apart from each other, almost 24 hours to the dot in one sense, where both were called home. So the articles on both Harry and Paul Tim Keller, were, you know, basically just telling brief details for a while, and then where you really find the impact is all the statements that have been made in various parts of social media and other news outlets with regard to the impact these men had in individual lives, in the church life, in the Presbyterian Church in America. Speaks about their background, how God prepared them for the ministries that they did have and the impact they have. And I think for a long time, they will have, you know, this kind of impact. So these first two articles, rightly so, extol the faithfulness, the ministry, the impact that God used with these men. They honored the giftedness he gave them to share the good news of Christ along the way. Now, having said that, someone else pointed out, I knew about one, but then others point out that just in this last week, or just coming up to this yesterday, actually, that really in the last week, there were at least five men who would be of the same stature, along with joining Harry and Tim and Glory, also entered into Glory. Last Sunday, a week ago, the 14th of May, Reverend Stephen Smallman passed away. He was 83. He was for 32 years the pastor of the McLean Presbyterian Church in the McLean, Virginia, just outside of D.C., and had a very impactful and distinguished ministry there. When he left there, he then became the president of World Harvest Ministries Mission, which is now called Surge. They changed their name following after Jack Miller. So he was called home. And then outside of our immediate Presbyterian Church in America family, but very closely related with the Free Church of Scotland, just yesterday, Don McLeod, who taught in the seminary and preached also greatly throughout the Scotland, well known to many, and at least men who study their theology and so forth, impacted by him. And also Gordon Keddie was longtime pastor in the Free Church, expositor, wrote quite a few books. All within this one week, it seemed all together that the Lord brought these men home to their eternal reward, as Paul says in 2 Timothy, to receive their crown of righteousness because of the Lord Christ. So I just thought I'd include all of those together so that we can see that the Lord takes away. Now, it's interesting that the last article that we will come to will sort of put this in perspective. So just hold on to this, and we will make some more comments on the 10th article that sort of bookends these two with that are in the Aquila report for this week. So anyway, this just calls us to recognize that we're all servants of Christ and we serve at his pleasure. There's a time to be born, time to die. The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And that has been the tone, interestingly, of just all of the social media posts that I've seen, of rejoicing in God's goodness and giving us such men who are were so gifted and used everything for his own glory.
Yeah, absolutely. And this goes without saying, I know, you know, people are praying for their families, but we should be reminded and continue to do so.
Absolutely. So that's one and two, rightly so. And then number three takes us just in a different direction. Matt Lee is a ruling elder at the Covenant Presbyterian Church in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and he's sort of our resident statistician, very schooled in that area. So he decided that he would take up wondering, what about Presbyterian Church in America congregations that have their own schools, whether it's just the preschool, maybe preschool and kindergarten, maybe the whole group from preschool all the way to high school. And so he thought he'd dive into that, and that's what he did. And so he starts out by referring to the fact that the General Assembly approved making statistical data digitally accessible. And so with that done, he was able to go into the digital record and ask the question, of the school, how many Presbyterian Church in America congregations have schools affiliated with them? And then what is there any, just impact, statistics, numbers, just sort of give a picture. It's not the whole thing, but at least it lays out the foundation. So he says, of the 1,669 churches reporting data, that means there's some that unfortunately haven't reported, but anyway, 1,669, only about 9% or 150 report having an educational ministry affiliated with their church. The churches with schools are significantly different from churches without schools in several meaningful ways. In short, they have more members, more elders and deacons, and more income and expenses. So it's an interesting factoid that he picks up from reading all the statistics. So he goes on to say, with respect to membership, PCA churches with schools are significantly larger. The average PCA church has 230 members on its rolls on average. Churches with schools average 630 on their rolls, while those without average 190. So you have average generally of 230, but if you just break them out with reference to school, having a school or not, it's 630 for those with schools and average, and the 190 that don't have a school. They have both more communicant members and non-communicant members. However, even churches with schools had a wide variation in membership. Half of the churches with schools had between 50 to 400 members, 50 and 400 members. So anyway, it's just, he breaks it out in every kind of way. So it's an interesting article if you haven't read it yet, to see the all the various signs that he found in this respect. It's by presbytery, he mentions that Evangel Presbytery has the most schools that are reported in the statistics with 10. Chesapeake Presbytery with 7. Southeast Alabama with 7. Central Florida with 6. All the way down to 4 or few, the 79 within 79 presbyteries. So it talks about the effects on the budget, the way the church is organized, and then he puts together some final thoughts. This preliminary report does not capture the full extent of the work PCA churches in ministering to families through education. Some churches with closely related to schools are not represented in the PCA data. For instance, he mentions one that's a large Christian school in Huntsville, Alabama. Other schools did not have information readily available on their website. Still, this article provides some helpful descriptive information, especially as many churches consider beginning their own educational ministries with the expansion of school choice around the across the country. So, it's a very easy read. Matthew writes well. He presents the numbers clearly. So it's not one of those things where you'll glaze over with too much information. It's really been helpful. So I've always appreciated how Matthew Lee provides this kind of information for us, Paul. It sort of puts things in perspective, which is nice.
Yeah, it really is. And it, I think it also goes to show the need here. I mean, I think we have a need to, have more schools, not just for the numbers aspect, but just for the fact that, God is the basis for all knowledge, and churches have that knowledge, and so they are in many regards the best equipped to educate young people on all of the other issues that that are out there that derive from knowledge of truth, which is knowledge of God.
Exactly. So anyway, we invite you'll enjoy reading that article by Matthew Lee. We got number 4 is by Carlton Wynn, who is an associate pastor at the Westminster Presbyterian Church in Atlanta, and he entitled Machen and the PCA Today. He says, this year is the centennial anniversary of the release of J. Gresham Machen's classic work, Christianity and Liberalism. But I'm just going to pause there for a minute. But I sort of got my hands around the fact it's okay. It was 1923. And of course I wasn't around that time anyway, but that's, you know, 100 years. And I, you know, I guess I, from the time I became a Christian, I was in, became familiar with Christianity, liberalism, read it early as a young believer. So I guess I just had it in my mind all the time. And I just never thought of it in terms of, you know, the putting these dates on it, because it was, to me, it was so contemporary that it's hard to imagine. But anyway, here it is 100 years. So it's a good, you know, good time for perspective. And that's what Carlton Wynn provides for us here. So he says here, this gives us the most opportune time for all in the Reformed denomination, not just Machen's own Orthodox Presbyterian Church, that is the OPC, to reflect on the still relevant insights Dr. Machen has left us. My own denomination, the Presbyterian Church in America, celebrates its 50th anniversary this year, having begun, of course, in 1973. So he says, PCA folks are providentially poised not only to give special praise to God for his grace and our expression of Christ's kingdom, but also to assess how we can grow as a church that is faithful to the scriptures and true to the Reformed faith and obedient to the Great Commission. So he says, so what can Machen teach the PCA is basically the theme of this article, and what is useful in these current days. And so he says, asking this question requires that we first dig down to the varying roots of the OPC and the PCA. At the first General Assembly of the OPC in 1936, Machen described the 34 ministers and some 5,000 brave souls who had joined him as, quote, members at last of a true Presbyterian church. By claiming to represent a true Presbyterian church, Machen implicitly declared the Northern Presbyterian Church in the USA, infected as it was with the rife spirit of modernism and liberal Protestantism, to be a false church. Over a decade earlier in Christianity and liberalism, Machen had already was already urging liberal ministers of the mainline denomination to withdraw from it in the interest of honesty, going so far as to suggest that the Unitarian Church is just the kind of church that liberal preachers may desire, which is quite a statement to be made. He said, but anyway, by contrast, the Southern Presbyterian Church, who founded the PCA nearly four decades after the birth of the OPC, styled their new denomination as a, quote, continuing Presbyterian church loyal to the scriptures and the Reformed faith. That is, while the founders of the PCA observed that the Southern Presbyterian Church in the United States, that is the PCUS, Presbyterian Church in the United States, was traveling a liberal course that made division inevitable, many of them envisioned the PCA to be distinctly mainline in orientation. Like Machen and the OPC, they wanted the PCA to preserve confessional Presbyterianism in America, but to do so in a way that could also achieve the larger goal of evangelizing and renewing American culture. Notably, the PCA has not always trumpeted just the dimension of its origin story, and there have always been those within its ranks who have resisted the mainline desire for cultural influence in favor of more thoroughly reformed identity. So what he does is making that comparison. What was the OPC like when it began in 1936? What is the PCA like when it was started in 1973 and now reaches a half century or 50 years as it comes together? So he says, as Machen put it in Christianity Liberalism, if one thing is plain, is that Christianity refuses to be regarded as a mere means to our higher end. Our Lord made that perfectly clear when he said, if any man comes to me and hate not his father and mother, he cannot be my disciple. Whatever else those stupendous words may mean, they certainly mean that the relationship to Christ takes precedence over all relationships, even the holiest of relationships, like those that exist between husband and wife and parent and child. Those other relationships exist for the sake of Christianity, not Christianity for the sake of them. Christianity will indeed accomplish many useful things in this world, but if it is accepted in order to accomplish those useful things, it is not Christianity. Christianity will produce a healthy community, but if it is accepted in the order to produce a healthy community, if it's not accepted, rather, then it's not Christianity. So he just says, here's what Machen said 100 years ago. Here's a measure for the PCA now. Can look at itself and see where are we in light of what Machen said. And because obviously there are things that are so much different after these 100 years, and yet there are things that are very similar. So he concludes here, there's much that the PCA can learn from J. Gresham Machen, but the two lessons surveyed above, to prioritize the gospel of Christ for its own sake and to express clearly one's confessional convictions on pressing matters within the church and the world, rise to the top. Machen believed the first of these tasks was and is vital to the existence of the church, and the second was and is critical to the church's long-term health. And he did so with firm resolve to submit his every engagement in the church and in the world to the law of love. After all, what kind of man can, quote, contend for the faith that was once delivered to the saints in such a way that even his ardent opponents praise him as at his death for his convictions and his grace? Only one who follows the footsteps of the king and head of the church, united in to him in life and death and into glory, perhaps in the end a whole-souled commitment to do just that, is the greatest legacy that Machen leaves the PCA today. So Paul, I think I remember you saying that you had been reading through a little bit ago the Christian
liberalism. I think that was last year. I recently picked it back up to reread it. I'm one of those that's terrible at starting a book and then not finishing it and then having to eventually, you know, start it again. So I started it again, I guess, about a week or two ago, you know, coincidentally. I can just say we can learn a whole lot from Gresham Machen and everything that he fought for and the arguments. And it really comes down to the sufficiency of Scripture. That's what's being challenged here. Back in the day, it was maybe slightly different, you know, saying that Jesus, you know, essentially denying the resurrection or denying what Jesus came here to do, which is sacrifice himself to save sinners, versus, you know, at the time they were having these intellectual debates about, well, the teachings of Jesus are good, and this is, we're going to focus on, you know, these teachings and not his core mission, not what he actually did, what he actually accomplished, satisfying the wrath of God on our behalf. And so that's you can see strings of that still today, you know, in different ways. And so that book, if you have not picked it up, Christianity and Liberalism, obviously it's helpful to know the context of the debate that was going on at the time he wrote it, but it is ever much the same thing is happening now. And it's very, very helpful to read his arguments and to compare them to what's going on today. I will say there is an article. You talk about a thread in these articles, Dominic. There is certainly a thread. And you already read this part of this article, but he says, like Machen and the OPC, they wanted the PCA to preserve confessional Presbyterianism in America, but to do so in a way that could also achieve the larger goal of evangelizing and renewing American culture. Mm-hmm. Notably, the PCA has not always trumpeted this dimension of its origin story, and there has always been those within its ranks who have resisted the mainline desire for cultural influence in favor of a more thoroughly reformed identity. So you can bookmark that statement, because in a couple of articles, when we get to the two kingdoms theology, right, it really kind of addresses that argument even more.
Absolutely. And in fact, it's in that article, it references, doesn't mention Machen particularly, but it does reference the what you just said. And that's a great point to make. And this is one of those areas that we'll see in just a moment, that where there's debate on in terms of how far the church goes into and for what reasons into those cultural adaptations, accommodation, and influencing, and so forth. So you're right. And I think that within just part of the DNA of Presbyterianism, and definitely of Reformed theology, is this struggle about how to engage culture and what that really means, and so forth. So we'll pick a little bit more of that up in just a minute when we get to that article. Okay, well, number four then is a response to an employer's request for pronouns. So this brings us sort of right square center in something that probably didn't exist, and I know didn't exist in 1923, 100 years ago. This by Amy K. Hall. You know, what do you do with the pronouns issue, because this is something that is so current, and the reason why it's even an article that raised interest on the part of the Aquila Report readers, so it's number four on the of the top 10. It says here, in the past we've talked about why a request for pronouns is not a neutral request. Okay, this is an article, and it's a hyperlink there so that you can go back to that articles to the reasoning behind it, the philosophical undergrounds, pinnings of why it's not neutral. It reflects a false and damaging worldview, one that's contrary to Christianity, and that would encourage Christians to decline to engage in exchanges of pronouns for this reason. So that is the reasons that exist in that article, that it's something that's contrary to the basic underpinnings of the Christian faith. But of course, it's easy to give that advice. It's much more challenging to live it out, which is why I pray, as the article says, for courage and wisdom for all those who suddenly find themselves in a situation where choosing to speak the truth could possibly cost them their job. I recently spoke to a Stand to Reason supporter who received a company-wide email saying leaders were expected to display their pronouns. After considering the cost and thinking carefully through his response, this is what he wrote. So here's how this particular employee responded to that company-wide email to the superiors above him. I appreciate the goal of mutual respect and creating a welcoming environment for everyone. My desire is to be respectful of everyone. The expectation to display my pronouns asks me to accept a premise I cannot accept, namely that my pronouns should be different than he/him. It's an ontological claim about the nature of reality, and that I hold a different view. I'm not asking those who are transgender to accept my view of reality, but I am being asked to accept theirs. I can live and work with respect toward anyone with differing beliefs than my own, including my transgender coworkers. Can I be expected in my belief that differ on the nature of gender and identity while affirming the dignity of every person? Can I be respected? Rather, I left that out. In my beliefs. In other words, I will honor the beliefs of those who are my coworkers. They need to honor also their coworker and me with regard to this. Well, as it turned out, the company accepted that, realizing that instead of enforcing one particular worldview and view of reality, that they would say everyone respect the other and let them, whatever their desire is, or that's grounded in that kind of reality, that be allowed. So now that's unusual, because in most cases, the one worldview trumps the other in such a way that you're being mandated to have to accept whatever the new one is, the one that leans more progressive. So in this article, Amy Hall then goes on just to give a few more situations. Says, your situation may not end as well as this man's, but as he told me, God has been reassuring me that if I lose my job, he is still good. Now, more than ever, we need to intentionally and deliberately trust that our good God works all things to the counsel of his will, and that the inspired words of Romans 8:28 are true. And so we should live accordingly. So this may be a model that if you're in that kind of situation, you can use, calling for mutual respect of the different worldviews that are standing alone, are on a collision course. And sometimes we will face it. So if that's where you are, this would be a helpful article. You know, here's some good language and wording that you might want to consider using. And so, Paul, you and I've talked about this before. There have been other articles touching on this and with different kinds of results.
Yeah, different kinds of results. A lot of times people lose their jobs. Praise the Lord, that didn't happen in this case. Somebody stood up for what they believed in, biblical worldview. So they're not bowing down to this request. And their employers, thankfully agreed and said, yeah, it's not mandatory. You don't have to do it. And I'm reminded of Rosaria Butterfield's I guess her piece that she wrote that was on the top 10 list several weeks ago at this point, you know, where she talked about how she used to use these pronouns and now she doesn't anymore because she thinks it was wrong. She came to the conclusion that was wrong and then wrote a whole article about it. That's very helpful. If you have anybody in your life that, you know, thinks is a Christian, but thinks that, you know, they need to, you know, kowtow to this pronoun nonsense, really, that article that she wrote is really helpful.
Yes, it is. And if you want to find it, just put that her name in the search box on the Aquila Report and the article will pop right up and you'll be able to read that. So, and by the way, since we already mentioned those one thread from the last article coming, we have another thread that will touch on this coming up with the number 8 article on that shows that in what way is culture shifting around us and what impact does that have? So stand by for that. Okay, the next article, Defending the Idol by Don and Joy Vinot. And the idol they're speaking about is what has become fairly popular, the Enneagram. And they start out in this article just talking about the book of Judges and how the people were led astray. You know, we saw the pattern of obedience and then accommodation, and then God brought judgment, and they lived and suffered until he sent another judge to lift them out of that. And so that whole pattern of everyone did what was right in his or her own eyes. So as the occult origins of Enneagram are pointed out to those happily engaged in the Enneagram craze, a very common defense is choosing to use the Enneagram or not is like the question of eating meat sacrificed to idols. That comes out of the question that Paul dealt with in 1 Corinthians 8. In other words, Christians are free to engage with the Enneagram as the Christians in the early church were free to eat meat that had been sacrificed to idol. But as our good friend and associate Marcia Montenegro succinctly points out, the Enneagram is not like meat sacrificed to idol. The Enneagram is the idol. And so that's quite a bold statement, because especially since you consider how many believers appear to have bought into the Enneagram, accept it, maybe even orient their whole lives and so forth. So the reason here is that this article presents is tries to make a case then that the issue is not is about shunning meat that was used in ritual to an idol, but that we are to flee from idolatry itself. This is pretty straightforward. Even so, then there are various presses, University Press, Onderman, Thomas Nelson, and Russell Moore at Christianity Today are all in on promoting this idol as the current spiritual tool of choice. And why not? Like the best of idols in the ancient past, this one is very profitable. So the reason for it is that the story behind the Enneagram is an ancient by the author is ancient, and that he channeled the specific Enneagram types through automatic writing, which is a spiritualist or spiritist thing. Naranjo's lies concerning the Enneagram's origin and his challenging of the specific occurred 6 years ago before University Press introduced the Enneagram idol into the evangelical church. When informed of its true origins and that of Naranjo's channeling of the types, IVP and the other publishers we can contact ignored the evidence and simply resent their form letter asserting that it's ancient origins. As more Christians are becoming aware of its occultic connection, that is becoming an increasing problem for the Enneagram priests and priestesses. Pastor Zach Tyler at a Gospel for Enneagram recently attempted to mitigate Naranjo's automatic writing confession in his Gospel for the Enneagram YouTube video. Quote, is the Enneagram demonic? An informed response. Is Tyler's providing an informed response, or he's just an uninformed or deceptive attempt to defense for something that is incompatible with biblical teaching? So the Vinots basically are challenging that and showing and highlighting how they believe that this is an idol. So it's not just capitulating to idolatry, something that's in the world that's unique, like eating meat sacrificed to idol, but it's that it's something that is so distinctive and contrary, that in contrast to everything that is Christian and what believers ought to be engaged in. So it's if this is something that you've been thinking about or you're engaged with, you're not sure about it, helpful article, good references, at least something to put in your head, your mind, your heart to consider seriously. Paul, it's all around us. I assume you hear folks mentioning, I think there's something about what number are you on the Enneagram or something like that. I'm not personally familiar with all that background, but.
I mean, I have very limited experience. I mean, I went to a church one time that, you know, wanted people to do the tests. I don't know if I ever did. I guess I weaseled my way out of it. I never liked standardized tests, and the Enneagram just gave me like post-traumatic, you know, recall of, you know, having to take tests in school and being all nervous. And that's the way I perceived any of this, you know, some sort of standardized method to evaluate people. It's like, hang on, wait a second. I'm a human being here. You know, I'm a unique human being. That was always my opposition to it. It's because it didn't, I just didn't set well with me. But to see it actually laying out the pagan roots behind it and the arguments being made here are really compelling. And, you know, I had no idea the acquisition, like when it talks about the core of shamanism. Did you catch that information coming from unseen realms? That would, of course, refer to higher sources, not historical sources. You've got to check this article out. I mean, it's a lot of information about the Enneagrams. And again, they say, you know, it's not that, that people try to compare it to sacrificing meat to idols. And they say, no, it's not meat to idols. It is the idol. That's what really grabbed my attention in this piece.
All right. And it's, again, it's one of those things where we have to, you know, be, you know, to test the spirit to see if they're really of God. And so it's something that they're presenting a point of view that's contrary to what is being held about probably in many other churches. And I give it a hearing. Okay, the next article is by William B. Evans, teaches at the Erskine Theological Seminary in Due West, South Carolina. The Two Kingdom Theology and Christians Today. It says the 2K theology is both less than biblical and less than faithful to the decided weight of the Reformed tradition. Now we hear these terms that they could turn around because, you know, if you're in the circle of certain groups, then they throw out the summary, Two Kingdom or not Two Kingdom, and it so it becomes very confusing, and sometimes even the various groups aren't able to give definitions to it. So in this article, Bill Evans really sort of helps to bring some clarity into the matter by giving some definitions. Let's see, he says, most recently an outspoken group has rejected all of this, contending that Christians should view themselves as citizens of two distinct kingdoms, the church and the world, and that efforts to transform society on the basis of Christian principles are wrongheaded. Okay, this then perspective that he's just given a summary of has been labeled 2K or Two Kingdoms or R2K, Reformed or Radical Two Kingdoms, or NL 2K, that is natural law, the NL for natural law kingdoms. And it is particularly associated with some present and former members of Westminster Seminary in California. So not surprisingly, it has also been recently dubbed by one theologian as the Escondido theology. So he says, what are the basics of the 2K or two kingdom theology? First, there are two realms or kingdoms, the world, which is governed by creational wisdom or natural law, accessible to all, and the church, which is shaped and governed by the gospel. Christians are citizens of both realms and are answerable to the claims of both. Second, because the world is normed by natural law, There is no distinctly, quote, Christian, close quote, worldview that can be applied to all of life. There is no Christian world and life perspective on politics or economics or psychology, etc. Finally, Christian efforts to transform or redeem society are wrongheaded and involve confusion of the two kingdoms. Thus, the ministry of the church is exclusively spiritual in nature. And so the sometimes you'll hear that put into the spirituality of the church and what that really means. And even there, it's applied differently. And we'll have an article probably next week on the top 10, I suspect, that will address that. So anyway, accordingly, those who are two kingdom advocates, such thinking is firmly rooted to them, is firmly rooted in the Christian tradition, and four key sources are often cited. For instance, St. Augustine of Hippo's Magnum Opus, which is the City of God, was written in the wake of the fall of Rome in 410 to the barbarians. In it, Augustine assures Christians that their hopes rest not in earthly society or empire, but in heaven, and he schematizes human history in terms of two cities. The city of the world, shaped by love of self and made up of those who live by human standards and are predestined to hell, and the city shaped by love for God and made up of those who live according to God's will and are predestined to heaven. Thus, Christians are simultaneously citizens of heaven and pilgrims on earth. Here, Augustine sought to express the biblical distinction between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of the devil. But Augustine was no Manichaean dualist. Manichaeanism coming out of a Persian background philosophically. He recognized that the inhabitants of the earthly city can accomplish relative goods. And he also believed that the efforts of Christians to do better, to better society can achieve real, if limited, results. How, moreover, Augustine encouraged a public role for distinctly Christian virtues, even arguing that temporal rulers could suppress idolatry. Thus, Augustine's two cities are not the same as the recent two kingdoms. So that starts the whole process out with what he, what Evans has given here on this, with regard to this two kingdom rule. Then he deals, he says another thread is what happened with Martin Luther. Luther modified the Augustinian framework by means of programmatic distinctions between the law and the gospel, between the spiritual and the temporal, between the inner and outer man. And he goes on to explain that. I won't read that, leave that for you to read, and that be a very helpful. But then, so after the Lutheran influence, there was the Reformed two kingdom advocates that spent a good deal of time trying to portray Calvin as a keen disciple of on Luther on this issue. But while Calvin deployed two kingdom language, he generally did so with somewhat different aims, and his practical stance was more activistic. He sought to protect the church from the encroachment of the state and emphasize that Christians have a spiritual obligation to the state, but the temporal realm does not have the independence that it has in Luther's construct. Despite similarities in language, the difference helps to account for the profound contrast between the passivity of the Lutheran tradition toward the state and the historic pattern of social and political activism evident among Reformed Christians. Calvin's role in Geneva underscores his conviction that distinctly Christian concerns have an important role in the public square and that magistrates are obligated to further Christian virtues. So you can see that's a trend that between Augustine, how he lays the foundation, then what Luther did with it, and then what Calvin did. And you can see that they're making very fine distinctions along the way. So he says these different conceptions of two kingdom are rooted to some degree in different understandings than of law and gospel. For Lutherans, the law always condemns, while the gospel is understood primarily as freedom from condemnation. The Reformed understanding of both differs. Here, the notion of law is conditioned by the doctrine of the covenant, and the gospel is understood as both freedom from condemnation of sin and the power of sin. Thus, in the Westminster Confession of Faith, the condemning of aspects of the law, the condemning aspects of the law, rather, are assigned to the covenant of works, while the law as a rule of life does sweetly comply with the grace of the gospel. For these reasons, Lutherans are able to distinguish law and gospel in a way that Reformed generally do not, and simply citing similarities in Lutheran and Reformed language on the two kingdoms, law, gospel will not do it. So what he basically is saying here and giving us this distinction, very helpful to make these distinctions, that Bill Evans is helping to, you know, bring about the you know, hopefully clarity, and more clear anyway, in the discussion of how do Christians in any age of the church, in any period of time, both understand their being members of the kingdom of God and also in the kingdom of this world, how do we manage and navigate through that vortex between the two? So he says, we will cheerfully admit the 2K advocates have some legitimate concerns, particularly that the mission and witness of the church not be hijacked by political and cultural agendas. But in this instance, the cure is worse than the disease. While 2K theology may well scratch the itch, Christians who need a theological excuse to remain silent in the current cultural conflicts, it is both less than biblical and less than faithful to the decided weight of the Reformed tradition. So I think a very helpful explanation that Bill Evan gives, as you look at some of the history, the narrative for the length of the article, it gives you a context. So if you're looking for something that just focuses in and gives some light, I think this is a helpful article.
And the last thing you just read is really the reason why he's dissecting this two kingdom theology, and he's showing the errors of it. He's showing how they are doing some revisionist history, you know, when it comes to trying to bring Calvin into this and the distinctions between Martin Luther and their opinions on this. It comes down to this being an excuse for remaining silent in the face of massive cultural degradation and depravity. That is, from what I can tell, that's one of the main points of this article, is we're going to break down this theology and we're going to explain why it's wrong and why it's not an excuse to remain silent among current cultural conflicts. I mean, you've heard, I'm sure many people have been in conversations with other believers, and inevitably you get something like, well, Jesus wasn't political. That's quite the claim. You know, Jesus wasn't political. It's like, oh, really? It was certainly perceived of it. His movement was certainly perceived as political by the Pharisees and the Sadducees. I can promise you that. So anyway, this is a great article. Really love it. I love how it goes into the depths of and the minutia of what, what are the issues with, 2K theology. It doesn't completely eviscerate it. It says there are legitimate concerns with it. Again, like you said, hijacking, the church being hijacked by the political and cultural agendas, that's obviously a danger. But the answer to that is not to overcorrect, stick your head in the sand and absolutely just do nothing about it. That's why I love the article. I think it's really good. So,
okay. Now keep in mind that the next article, it's just interesting that these would be back to back with the seventh and eighth article. The eighth article goes to that mythical 30,000 foot observation, so you can get a bigger picture of the landscape. So the two kingdoms one is sort of presses in a little closer. So now we draw back, and it's the emergence of a new paganism. There's a title, an interview with Chantal Del Sol, by Jonathan Van Maren. In this article, what he does, it gives us that, like I said, the 30,000 foot picture, because it takes us back to the beginning of New Testament Christianity and to the present in terms of what existed for the first 300 years. What was it like? So he starts out by referring to a book that came out in 2020 The Final Pagan Generations, Rome's Unexpected Path to Christianity. And he says, Edward J. Watts details the daily life at the end of an age. Okay, now, so what is the Roman pathway at that point? They existed. It was when Christianity came into existence in its New Testament form. That is, the Old Testament church came to its conclusion, consummation in Christ. Pentecost is the administration now of the New Testament form of the church. But it's not the birth of the church, as the church continues, but now it's focused now on the death, burial, resurrection, ascension of Christ, as he is the head of the kingdom, seated in righteousness at the right hand of the Father. All right, so, but when Pentecost came, there was, well, remember, there was 120 in the upper room before Pentecost, then 3,000 came to faith in Christ as the preaching of Peter at Pentecost. So now the church was 3,120. Well, what was the population like in the rest of the world? It was quite large, and so Christianity itself was just minuscule, that New Testament church, and it grew, and it started preaching the gospel and engaging in culture in many ways, and went through persecutions. Why? Because it was so different. It was in everything about it was in contrast to the prevailing Roman culture, which was based on the gods and their superstitions that they had. Okay, so, but by the 300 years later, just around the time of Constantine, then all of a sudden things began to change, and that's where the title comes from, Rome's Unexpected Path to Christianity. So he says that in the it was in the early 300s, and the final pagan generation, he writes. Now, it didn't mean the paganism went away, by the way. He makes that clear. But in terms of its dominant influence, something was interfering with paganism's ability to be the number one. He writes, was born into a vast sacred infrastructure that had been built up over the past three millennia. So that's the church and its growth throughout the Roman Empire. The gods were everywhere, woven into the language, commerce, daily rituals, and the very landscapes of every city and town. The gods, referring with a small g, were an omnipresent and accepted assumption. Many of the Roman elites no longer believed in the literal existence of these deities, but they were seen as necessary myths, a foundational part of the social order. Nobody could anticipate how swiftly everything would change. So Watts then begins by describing a face-off in Alexandria, Egypt, in which pagans, enraged by the conversion of their ancient shrine into a church, rioted in the streets, killed and wounded several Christians, and barricaded themselves in their shuttered temple until the emperor promised them a pardon. When they left the Serapeum, the Christians tore it apart, triggering a wave of idol smashing across Egypt in the weeks that followed. It was a watershed moment in which many pagans finally realized that their empire was being remade, and that the Christians' attack would reach the most permanent and impressive elements of urban religious infrastructure. But the final pagan generation, Watts is referring to, is the last of the elite Romans, both pagan and Christian, born into a world that simply could not imagine a Roman world dominated by a Christian majority. None could grasp that they stood at the dawning of a new age and that all old things were passing away. That's quite a statement, Paul, when you think about it, that the Christianity is the one that was in the ascendancy. It was the one that was changing the culture by just the preaching of the gospel and having its salty influence in the culture. So they were the ones that were saying, hey, name things this way and that way, instead of the pronouns that we're having today. So what the focus on this article, let me continue. I don't want to lose the thought. So remember now, it's Christianity was the new boy on the block. Idolatry, paganism was the standard. It controlled the whole dynamic, the framework, the thinking of the whole of life. Now, many now argue that we stand, though this is not today, at a similar threshold today. In the West, we are not at the end of we are at the end of 1600 years of Christian civilization. The culture and the foundational underlying assumptions have all changed, and people have passed from Christendom into a new world. So the French philosopher and historian and novelist Chantal Delsol believes that we are not simply becoming post-Christian. Rather, we are re-paganizing. In her book of 2021, The End of the Christian World, she observes that we have yet to fully understand that we are living what we're living through, nothing less than the death throes of a civilization that lasted 16 centuries. So that means you go back to the 300s. This slow motion death began with the French Revolution, she argues, which, unlike the Dutch and American revolutions, produced the first civilization that did not rest on Christian assumptions. Once Christianity faced off with modernity, Delsol said, the handwriting was on the wall. And even though a handful of elites deluded themselves into believing in the future of atheism, most people need gods. And soon the old gods began to creep back in. So this is Van Maren speaking about Delsol. Our new society, in fact, still has saints and sinners. They have simply swapped places. Christians who condemn unbiblical sexual behavior are damned as wicked for their intolerance, while the gilded homosexuals of our celebrity elites are instead celebrated for, quote, being who they are. This change seems to have happened rather suddenly, facilitated by the fact that even those who no longer believe in Christianity have continued its cultural practices, even at the end of the age where it was approaching. When the end finally came, it seemed to happen overnight. In 2008, U.S. President Obama ran for office opposing same-sex marriage. But a mere decade and a half later, in 2022, most Democrats wouldn't dare question the ritual mutilation of children in the name of transgenderism. And much like the pagans of the fourth century, Christians have simply been caught off guard. See, Paul, you see the transition that is what their analogy is taking place. The pagans and the Roman pagans and all their gods and all their philosophy were caught off guard. Christianity and its impact, not only with gospel presentation, people becoming believers, the church being established, they were bringing in the Christianized version of culture. And all of a sudden, the pagans said, what's going on here? They were the ones on the run. Now it's flipped. And so we're talking about the re-paganization of the world, comparable to what happened in with the Christians Christianizing the pagan nations. Yep. Now pagans are seeking to paganize the Christian impact and influence over a period. And, you know, nothing happens overnight. It's over a period of time. Yep. Where things slip. So this article is just outstanding to say, what has happened is, in essence, is Christianity has lost its ability to speak into the world and to have the impact, not only with just the pure preaching of the gospel, but in terms of how things are structured culturally, how we're to frame things, even for the non-Christian world. That's what happened when the last Roman generation fell apart. And now it's the opposite is taking place. So excellent, excellent article. I just commend this one for you to give time to, because the articles that we have been showing and the things that are grabbing the attention of Christians today are very much in this range, Paul. That's what we've been talking about.
You're right. And, you know, the repaganization, that's exactly what's going on. And, you know, my question would be if that does come to fruition, you know, completely, totally, which it certainly feels like it is, how long will society be able to stand? You know, how long until the whole thing implodes? I mean, right now, just from a sheer biological standpoint, you know, a lot of people that are succumbing to this new paganism that are, you know, just obsessed with sexual identity, they themselves are not going to procreate. They are, you know, basically, as you know, some think it's part, I agree with this, part of a massive depopulation effort as well, where you have those who subscribe to it aren't having children, and then you have those who are doing the trans thing. They're not going to be able to have kids. And so I'm just wondering, yes, I do see it happening, but I'm wondering how long it lasts before it crumbles. Likewise, not just with the gender stuff. You look at the cultural Marxism, which relies on new marginalized groups that eventually result in there just being a person of one complaining about being marginalized and pointing at everybody else around them for all of their, you know, all of life's troubles. I don't see how that can last, you know, forever either. I think that's why there's a lot of people, Christians, who are, you know, thinking about, well, what do we do when we rebuild? I think people are seeing 10, 20, 30 years down the road that this is all going to collapse on itself. And what are you going to do next? How do we as Christians, you know, be productive, be good stewards and rebuild from what looks to be just a coming complete train wreck? Now, the difference between paganism back then, Dominic, and paganism now is that technology is certainly makes it much easier for tyrants to enslave populations. I mean, you know, artificial intelligence is a huge danger, not to mention just the surveillance state and everything else. So we just need to, you know, pray to go about our lives, you know, in peace and to not have to worry about any of this stuff. But it's certainly happening, and we don't need to stick our heads in the sand, as I
mentioned. Well, I think, I think the point is that if you take the analogy, if there's some merit that how the pagan culture lost out to and the culture became more Christianized. I didn't say that everyone became a Christian, but the Christian impact was there, but it took 300-400 years for it to manifest itself. The same thing is happening in reverse. And the question that is being asked is why? And that's partly due to the fact that there hasn't been the articulation clarity of how what the first 300-400 years of Christianity did in its culture that we have stopped doing in this culture in terms of impact. That's the point. So it doesn't, we've sort of depended, I would say now, as the Romans did, or the broad Roman culture, the pagan culture, in the power of government, the laws that were passed and so forth to maintain their paganism, Christianity is, because of its moral impact, its salty moral impact, transferred that even without a single law being passed. Just think about that. There was no legislature that was passing Christian laws most of those 300 years. So now we think if the church is depending on keeping control of the government, have the government pass laws about being anti-abortion and being anti-transgenderism and so forth, as opposed to the church speaking into the culture and living out sort of the moral impact of and salty impact of the gospel without having to depend on government to make laws. And I think that's part of the, you know, the loss that's here. So, for instance, one question, what overt signs of repaganism do you see? This is Van Maren asking Del Sol. Insofar as paganism is defined as a belief in a world filled with immanent gods, we can say that environmentalism may belong to pagan thought. Animals, plants, and elements of nature in general use are often considered sacred and even adored. This belief is different from those that preceded Christianity. Nevertheless, it is a return to the veneration of sacred nature. Moreover, what is called pagan reflects to societies with pragmatic and consequential morality, unlike Christian, Jewish, or Islamic moral codes, which are based on transcendent dogmas. Pagan society belongs to the great Pan, god of sex and violence. In this respect, our societies are becoming pagan once again. We do not lack morals, but our morals are no longer anchored in absolute principles. They are pragmatic and consequentialists. In pagan societies, religions deal with rituals. It is the state that decrees and governs morality. This is what we see in postmodern Western societies today. So there's that transformation that's taking place on this nature. So anyway, just excellent article to say, let's look at the big picture and then to say, how do we engage here is that the Christians, the people of God have to make a case into the world as it sees both at the, to use the other phrase from the other article, there's a special grace part in which the gospel has its impact, where God is redeeming people out of the kingdom of Satan. He's rescuing us from the kingdom of Satan and bringing us into the kingdom of Son, whom he loves. And then what impact we do in terms of making sure that the discipling going on transforms their actions because of what the absolutes of Scripture gives to the Christians as we live in a world that is contrary to everything that is godly and biblical. So that's where I see it. And I think these two articles together, one explaining the two kingdom, one of the emergence of a new paganism, that running to our state legislature or to Congress to get new laws enacted, well, that'd be part of it. But there's more to it, where we have to bring the clarity of the gospel and the common grace benefits, or natural law benefits, if you want to use that, that speak to this. So even the pagan heart in some fashion is held at bay. Well, we'll leave it at that, because this should produce a good one. This, by the way, I would copy that article, keep it, and that one should be on your small group, Sunday school group, and other places to study. Okay, number 9. It comes back to how the church itself, if it's not careful, loses its way. And so we now come back to an article, to a concept that we've covered probably over the last couple of years, but it's coming to a real head here in the United Methodist Church. The UMC, the United Methodist Church bishops, request a 2026 general conference as hundreds more churches disaffiliate. To date, at least 2,800 churches have left the United Methodist Church since 2019, according to the United Methodist News Service. So United Methodist bishops opposed a 5-day meeting of the denomination's global decision, making embody the general conference for May of 2026. Now, this is global, so that means they want the guys, the churches from that used to be the mission churches in Africa and Asia and Latin America. This comes at the end of the Council of Bishops spring meeting last week in Chicago, and a weekend that saw hundreds of United Methodist churches in the United States leave the denomination. So the 2026 General Conference would focus on reestablishing connection within the United Methodist Church, lamenting healing and recasting the mission of and vision for the mainline denomination after years of strife over the ordination and marriage of its LGBTQ members, according to a press release published on May 8th. So the thing that brought the division, and where most divisions have taken place over the last 70 or so years, within what we'd call the Protestant movement, mainline Protestantism, mainstream Presbyterian Protestantism, maybe even broad evangelicalism, whatever it is, the main thing that has not been a theology of your view of God or theology of who Christ is in terms of humanity and divinity, or maybe even a definition of the gospel. It's been on the nature of what is the ethics and the teaching on human sexual ethics and behavior. And that is what has probably upset and disturbed more than anything else. I suspect it's because the whole idea of our interaction in culture is something that everyone does, male and female, and anything that goes contrary to that in some fashion, even intuitively, maybe at the conscience level, doesn't seem doesn't make sense. It doesn't seem to fit. And that has divided the church more than any other issue in the last 70 to 50 to 70 years. Paul. So the Methodist, these desiring the Methodist bishops, see if we can come together. Well, the people are leaving because the decisions the bishops have made and have taken the United Methodist Church in a certain direction. And there's no way that it's going to be any way to recast a vision for the restoration of the United Methodist Church as it once was. So Paul, it's, yeah. But the article is symptomatic of what has been happening at other denominations as well. We've just in the last couple of weeks, we had articles on this, on the Anglican Church and how it's breaking up and fracturing over the issue of the LGBTQ issues. And so we see that, Paul, regularly.
Yeah, no, we do. And I'll just say, you know, for whatever reason, the United Methodists here in Arkansas are not letting certain churches leave who voted to leave. And now it's tied up in court. And there's been several judges that have recused themselves. And they're saying it's going to maybe even go to the Arkansas Supreme Court as to whether or not they're going to let this Methodist church that, you know, from what I can tell, from what I've read, did everything they were supposed to do, had the vote. The majority was, we want to leave. And the higher ups in the Arkansas United, I don't know, conference, I guess, I don't know what you call it, in the polity there, they're saying no. And it's really ugly, quite frankly. And it's, you know, unbelievable that this is happening. But I think it's because a lot of people who believe in the union of, you know, LGBTQ and, you know, Christianity, they don't really know how to take a loss, because everywhere else in the culture, as I've said many times, they never lose. You know, you know what I mean? Like, it's always, mm-hmm. it's promoted by every mainstream institution is telling all of us that the LGBTQ agenda is good for you, you know. And this is the public saying, no, we're rejecting this, and it's tough for many to take.
Absolutely. Okay, well, we end hopefully on a upbeat note. The number 10 article, very simple title, Faithful, Fruitful, and Forgotten. Now, that is a spinoff, and it's referred to here at the very end of this article from a statement that Count von Ludwig von Zinzendorf, it's a mouthful to say, but well, prominent Christian that helped in forming the Moravian Church, impacted the church at large. He was a wealthy man, had a large estate, and he turned the estate into a campus, in essence, for training believers to get ready to go into all parts of the world and take the mission. So he's one of the fathers of the modern mission movement and sending them out. And he also impacted John Wesley a good bit as well. But the point is that when he, as the next group of missionaries were going out from Herrnhut, which the name of his work there, the House of God, he would give them a little word of encouragement, exhortation, and he would say to them, go and preach the gospel, die, be forgotten. So that's it. And that's your exhortation. Preach the gospel. Now, I've sort of guzzied it up a little bit. And I like, preach the gospel faithfully, die, be forgotten. So in this article on Faithful, Fruitful, Forgotten, by Jacob Crouch, he basically starts out quoting Acts 11, 19 through 21. And because of the nature of it, I'm going to just read it very quickly. Acts 11, 19. Now, those who were scattered because of the persecution that arose over Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia and Cyprus and Antioch, speaking the word to no one except Jews. But there were some of them, men of Cyprus and Cyrene, who on coming to Antioch spoke to the Hellenists, that is the Greeks, also preaching the Lord Jesus. And the hand of the Lord was with them, and a great number who believed turned to the Lord. Okay, so then Crouch says, Stephen was martyred, the church was scattered, and circumstances seemed pretty bad. Yet, even in the midst of persecution, the early church went out and preached the gospel wherever they went. And you would think that God would highlight the lives of these brave Christians who went out preaching the word boldly in the face of opposition. We know their stories. Our children would be named after them. They'd be venerated, and their fame would spread throughout the church. But God doesn't do that. Instead, we get this sentence: "But some of them, men of Cyprus and Cyrene." Well, that's it. No fancy titles, no family lineage, not even a name, just some men preaching the gospel, and a great number believe. And in an old, odd way, I find this incredibly encouraging. And that's what Zinzendorf said as well. So basically, he said, we're to be faithful without fame. So you're going to be preaching what's true. Here are these men who are faithful, and they live faithful for God alone. They didn't get fame. No biographies were written. None of them, they are still faithful. A brother once told me that he thought people didn't pray as much as they ought because no one was supposed to know when they prayed. Ouch. We memorize and read the Bible easily enough because others can tell. But he says, but those secret things often are often get neglected because there is no glory for them. And we have to be careful on that. So he says, but even though they were without fame, they weren't without fruit. God's testimony of these men was that a great number believed. They weren't famous, but they were fruitful. So, and then it's all done. It mentions also there for his glory. So he ends up in this article, Grouch does. I suspect that not many of us will be famous men or women. Our labors will go largely unnoticed, and our names will not likely live on beyond our families. Oh, but may God use us in mighty ways. May we be some of those men, some of those women who preach the word and see large numbers turn to the Lord. And may we be faithful, fruitful, and forgotten while the Lord is lifted up. So preach the gospel faithfully, die, and be forgotten. So it's a great way to remember that with the deaths of these great men that we spoke about at the very beginning, whose articles take up, they take a special place. You know, Stephen received his accolade in Acts 6, 7, and 8. And so the same thing would be true of Paul and Peter, but very few others are really listed as great saints, but yet many others whom the Lord calls, and they scattered everywhere. The Lord is getting his glory through this. So instead of us thinking negatively and being sorrowing about all the things that are happening in our culture, we remember that we bring the light into the decadence and the darkness of that culture. So Paul, I just think it's a great way to end this top 10. I'm glad it's here, and I'm glad it was number 10 so we could end with it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The top 10 list did not disappoint again, and it's good to be reminded that we are the salt and we are the light. We are tasked with exposing the darkness and understanding that it's also not up to us. We're doing it for the glory of God, and he is the one that calls, and he is the one that makes sure his kingdom advances, and we are just but mere vessels. So
right. Well, that brings us to the end of the Aquila Report in Weekly Review. We had a great list it was, and I trust that tomorrow when you get your list that you'll take the time to reach through them. You can forward the email, the newsletter itself. It's easily forwardable. Encourage others to read the Aquila Report on a regular basis as we aggregate different articles that will stir the heart and mind of believers so that we can live faithful in our generation. And so even though others may not know who we are, won't have our names, that we will be doing it all for the glory of God and live righteously in the midst of all the darkness that's around us. So we don't have to fear that darkness because we live in the light. And so with that in mind, we, Paul, Harold, and I wish you a very good week living and walking in that light.